I'll ask Mike Leonard about that in a moment, but we'll get him on the line here. Say hello, Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, Leonard Trial Lawyers. Mike, hello. Happy Saturday.
John, excited to be here, you know, for a couple of reasons. Number one, I love your show, but, you know, it keeps me out of the heat and keeps me from doing any Saturday chores at the house, more importantly.
That's great. Do you sometimes, even when you aren't on the show, pull out the phone, go in the corner and be like, sorry, honey, I'm doing the show right now, and she doesn't check up on the work?
That's a great strategy. I have to employ that. I haven't used that yet, but I think that could work at least for a couple hours every Saturday, right?
Yeah, although it might be a sad state of affairs that you would sit in the corner and talk to nobody for an hour instead of just picking up your socks, Mike.
Yeah, I think that's pretty pathetic. So we'll try to avoid that strategy.
I do want to get into Ed Burke and some other things you're working on. You brought up the death of 87-year-old Judge Leinenweber. I believe I'm saying his last name correct. You wanted to talk to him about him a little bit, huh?
Yeah, I think we should take a minute out and talk about Judge Harry Leinenweber. He was on the bench for almost 40 years in federal court in Chicago. Had a great career before that. He was a Notre Dame guy. I hate to say that because, you know, I don't like Notre Dame, John, but we'll give him his props. And then University of Chicago law school graduate, practiced law, was in the Illinois legislature for about 10 years, and was just a great judge on the bench in federal court in Chicago for so long. And I think the reason why he was so respected, I think, as his son said during the eulogy, he liked lawyers. You know, he really let you do your thing in court. He liked the craft. He liked to preside over trials. So a big loss to the bench, and interesting funeral in that every judge from the Northern District, every federal court judge, you know, came down the aisle in black robes to honor him and be part of the funeral mass. So I thought that was pretty interesting and impressive. And I had never seen that before. And some great eulogies given by his son, who's a lawyer as well, and another son who's a doctor. So hats off to Judge Leinenweber.
His wife is still alive, right?
Correct. Man. She is. Lynn Martin, yeah, another well-known political figure in Illinois and Chicago.
Yeah, she was the Secretary of Labor, for God's sakes, and a congresswoman from Illinois in the 80s.
Exactly.
How close do you get to a judge? I mean, I know each judge is different, and it depends on how often you see them. We've talked before about the camaraderie between lawyers even. Well, I don't know if you have camaraderie with the Fed lawyers, Mike, but maybe some other ones that you, even on opposing sides, you know, you have a respect for, or might grab a drink every now and then. Is there a more of a defined line between that and judges, just simply to kind of make sure that everything is up above board and impartial, or do some judges become friends with lawyers?
Yes, it's a difficult one. I think, you know, the friends that the judges had before they took the bench, of course, they're going to continue those relationships. However, I think there is a difference in that they have to be very careful about, you know, who they're with and all that sort of stuff, because someone could accuse them of the appearance of impropriety on a case. So I think that is an issue for all judges, and it makes their job, you know, a little lonely, so to speak, in some ways, I've heard. But yeah, you don't usually develop a relationship outside the courtroom with the judges. I mean, you definitely enjoy the chance to see them in different contexts and have some conversations with them. But yeah, it's different than your fellow lawyers or your opposing lawyers, because, you know, surprisingly, oftentimes you get along great with the other side. Sometimes you don't, but more often than not, you do. Even in the criminal world, you know, prosecutors and defense lawyers can be good friends at times, and can maintain those relationships. And as you get older, you realize that that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, and you don't have to be yelling and screaming at each other all the time. And sometimes that's very not good for your client.
Yeah, not good for your client, and also not good for your blood pressure. I mean, these are people you have to work with and see again all the time.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it depends on the lawyer's style and experience, but I think over time, you know, that's changed for me. I used to think that, you know, it was a death battle, and the other side you couldn't talk to, and you had to beat, and, you know, you had to yell at and, you know, get angry with and all that sort of stuff. And you kind of, as you grow and get more experienced, you hope that changes, and certainly changed for me a bit.
Just to kind of wrap up the chat about Leinenweber, Judge Leinenweber, what kind of a judge was he? What would you expect? What would paint us a picture of how he ran his court?
I think just, you know, a very respectful guy of all the people that were in front of him, treated everyone very well. Certainly not a judge that anyone would ever say, you know, that they felt they didn't get a fair shake in front of him or they weren't heard. And certainly wasn't someone who was ever disrespectful to the lawyers or to the litigants, and I think went out of his way to be very cordial and professional to everybody. You know, whether he was going your way or not is a different thing, but he just definitely treated everyone in such a professional, respectful manner that I think everyone enjoyed practicing in front of him. And, you know, being a former trial lawyer and having that mentality, I think he just enjoyed presiding over cases that went to trial. So that attempts to sum it up very briefly, but just a good guy on the bench that everyone respected.
And he was still working up to 87. Now, he was a senior judge for a while, which gives him a little bit more limited scope of work, right?
Yeah, he wasn't given up. And actually, in fact, he just presided over last year of the R. Kelly trial in Chicago. So he'd slowed down a bit, but certainly was still pretty active on the bench.
Yeah, appointed by Ronald Reagan in Reagan's second term, but early in the second term, since 1985 in that court. Okay. One text, by the way, Mike, before we hit the break. Maybe you could think about your answer before you give it to me. 847, please ask this clown why he doesn't like Notre Dame. Mike, why don't you think about that? Come up with a succinct and kind response to the best of your ability. Mike had a dig at Notre Dame at the start of the show, and someone said, can you ask this clown why he doesn't like Notre Dame? Someone, though, I will say, Mike, immediately stuck up for you and said, can you blame Mike Leonard? I say not. All right, you got 10 seconds.
Boy.
What don't you? I don't want to throw anyone under the bus here.
No, two things. Notre Dame is like the Yankees, you know? It's like, you either love them or you hate them. But in my case, my parents were both Marquette grads, and they went to Marquette in the late 50s. So from a kid growing up, my dad just hated Notre Dame anytime they were on TV playing a sports game, especially when they played Marquette. So it was just bred into me that you had to hate Notre Dame. But, of course, I acknowledge it's a great school. It's a great place to go. People love it. They're great in all their various ways. And, you know, I'm an equal opportunity hater. I hate, you know, the 12 or so teams in the Big Ten that are not the University of Iowa. So my hate's not limited to just one school.
No, yeah, you are an equal opportunity hater. That is well documented. That was a great answer, Mike. I feel like you had just been admonished by a judge and were trying to be kinder in front of the jury.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I obviously have a lot of respect for Notre Dame, but it's just funny how that was such a rivalry to my parents going to Marquette in the 50s. And I don't think the rivalry between Marquette and Notre Dame is as harsh as it was back in the old days, but maybe I'm not in tune with it. But, yeah, it's kind of like the Yankees. You're going to love them or you're going to hate them. And so I think there's a lot of lovers and a lot of haters.
All right, let's talk about Ed Berg. Can you just reset this for us? We're getting a sentencing on Monday for what he was found guilty of. Just give us the broad strokes, Mike, on what he was found guilty of ahead of the sentencing on Monday.
Yeah, in simplistic terms, racketeering, bribery, basically a number of different schemes were put forth by the government at the trial, where essentially what they're alleging is that he was trying to use his office as an alderman and that power that he had to leverage that against a bunch of different businesses and individuals to attempt to get them to give him law business to his law practice in exchange for favorable treatment in his capacity as a city council alderman and someone who is very powerful. So in the trial, they alleged out like three or four different schemes. One involved the old post office and the redevelopment of that. One involved a Burger King restaurant. And one involved the Field Museum, you know, different alleged schemes that he was found guilty of. So essentially using his office as a means to leverage business for his law firm in terms of just kind of a simplistic explanation of the case.
And some of them he was unsuccessful of providing that leverage, right? But that didn't matter.
Yeah, that was the funny thing. So, you know, you can attempt to commit a crime and you can extort someone or, you know, try to do a lot of stuff, and even though you don't succeed and don't get paid for it, and the bribery attempt or extortion attempt doesn't succeed, you can still be found guilty. And it was all under the umbrella of racketeering as well. So, yeah, the interesting thing in the sentencing memos, and we can talk about that in a second, is that's one of the things the defense lawyers pointed out. Like, look, he really didn't even personally profit from these schemes. But I think we should kind of stop back and set up the whole sentencing process before we get into the arguments of both sides.
I love when you produce my show for me, Mike. You're right, though. Let's set it up a little bit. That's a great call.
Yeah, so in federal court, and it's a little bit different than state court, there's a very, I wouldn't say rigid, but a very particular process that goes into a sentencing hearing. And so Alderman Burke is going to be sentenced on Monday, just in a couple days. But before all that happens, there's a lot of work that goes into the sentencing hearing. So it's not as if they're all just showing up and arguing to the judge and saying, gee, we think it should be 0 years, and the government's saying it should be 10 years. But what instead happens is that both sides submit lengthy sentencing memos in which they're arguing to the court what the appropriate sentence is. Defendant typically attaches a small number or great number of what are sort of referred to as character letters. So in the case of Alderman Burke, they did something that was pretty unprecedented. They submitted about 200 letters.
From a who's list of Chicagoans, by the way.
Yeah, so you had people, and it was interesting. I think they did a really good job, the defense lawyers for Burke, in giving a court a cross-section of the community. So it wasn't just, hey, I worked with him in the city council, or, you know, you had people from Gary McCarthy, the former, you know, police chief. He had politicians. But I think where they did the greatest job is attaching letters from everyday people that Burke came across during his, you know, 50, 60, 70-year career, and who gave – it wasn't just saying, I think he's a great guy or he's a nice guy or, gee, he did a good job as a politician. What they got out of a lot of these people were specific incidents of generosity or kindness. You know, I had someone die in my family. Burke's the first one that stood up, you know, paid for the funeral, you know, all those types of stories of generosity and kindness and public service, against a sentencing memo from the government, which kind of tried to paint him exactly the opposite. Instead of a man of public service, the government took the position, has taken the position, he's a guy that misused, abused, and exploited his office for all these years, and now he's got to pay the piper. You know, so two very different submissions in the sentencing memos. And then a third thing that happens is there's a lengthy interview with the defendant in every federal case. And so there's what's called a pre-sentence report prepared, which is rather lengthy, and it kind of tells the person's entire life story, from anything from your youth to your medical condition to your financial condition. And the judge and the lawyers all get that as well. And so on Monday, a lot of the work will have already been done. And so kind of the theater of the hearing will be trying to, you know, emphasize points that you've already made to the judge in writing and highlight those things. And the million-dollar question will be, will Burke address the court himself, which he has the right to do, but it's not required to do that.
And admit that he was wrong, right? I think the remorse thing's an interesting angle.
Well, yeah, so it's always a tough thing for a defendant in federal court, because you have the opportunity to address the court at the end. So you have this hearing on Monday. The judge will have to decide a lot of legal issues as a procedural matter. You know, what is the appropriate sentencing range under what's called the federal sentencing guidelines? But practically, you know, both sides will be arguing a lot of common sense things about Burke's character. And then when that's all done, when the judge decides, okay, here's what the sentencing guidelines should be for this case, I've heard all these arguments of counsel, I've read all the submissions, I've considered all the letters, then Burke would be given the opportunity to address the court. And the problem with that is oftentimes, first of all, for a defendant who is not admitting to their guilt, who is appealing their case, it's very difficult for them to step up before the court and say, gee, judge, you know, I did it, I'm remorseful for my conduct and all that stuff. Because you're worried about, you know, the implications for the appeal, and you're worried about the implications if the case ever comes back, you know, that you made certain admissions. So I think it's likely that Burke may simply choose not to address the court at all, which he certainly has the right to do, and the judge cannot consider that against him. On the other hand, though, at many, many federal sentencing hearings where the defendant has been found guilty or pled guilty, one of the tactics would be to ask for remorse, to say you're guilty, to, you know, apologize to the people you've hurt, all that sort of stuff. And sometimes that's extremely meaningful to the sentencing judge.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how it all plays out. I don't want to finish. I don't want to give you a whole other question here, Mike, because we're about a minute away from the news here. But I do want to pick up some other questions after the news. We do get some texts already rolling in. I'm curious, WGN radio listeners, if you were the judge, he's 80 years old. He's been convicted of these crimes. The feds are asking for 10 years. I think Ed Burke would prefer nothing. 616 says, this reminds me of my great-grandparents talking about all the good Capone did in the community. I could see the allusion to it, although, of course, in Capone's cases, a lot of people ended up dead at his hands, essentially, or his orders. They're different, but okay. 708 says, 6 months home confinement. 708, another one says he should be in jail. He's generous with others, yes, but he was more generous with himself. I want to ask you, Mike Leonard, not to say how much you would say, unless you feel comfortable saying that after the news, but also, like, is this really a deterrent? What else can be done to try and fight corruption here in Chicago? If lengthy sentences clearly have not worked in this city, will anything? We'll get Mike Leonard's opinion on that. Mike, we're talking about Ed Burke and his sentencing. You walked us through all the things that happened and the what both sides kind of do as they present their case to the judge, who has the ultimate call here. Seems like prosecutors want 10 years, and I don't know, does a judge take into consideration, you know, the idea that the sentence is supposed to then, to other political figures, be a deterrent to engage in similar crimes? Or can a judge also look at the fact that it doesn't seem to work here?
Yeah, here's why the job is so tough. I mean, first of all, you have a judge, Judge Kendall, who will preside over this, who has to give the sentence. And she's a great judge. Loyola Law School graduate, 1991, like me. Little shout out. But in any event, what a tough job, because you have to consider numerous factors. Okay, so for instance, some of the big ticket things she has to consider: the nature and circumstances of the offense, the history and characteristics of the defendant, the need for the sentence to reflect the seriousness of the offense, the deterrence, not only on the defendant, but generally deterrence, like what effect will this sentence have on other people who might want to engage in the same conduct, and other factors such as trying to avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities, meaning for similar conduct, people should get similar time is the idea, right? And then your listeners had a bunch of great questions before the break and brought up facts that are all relevant and germane to her determination. The age of the defendant and his physical condition is relevant. Those are factors that will be considered by her. The fact that you're 80, it's relevant for a number of reasons, because the idea is that, hey, if you give a lengthy sentence, this person, they actually might die in prison. The other idea is that because of their age, they're a very low risk of engaging in criminal conduct again, meaning a low risk of recidivism, what's called. So she's got to balance, Judge Kendall, all of these different things. And John, you brought up a great point, this whole concept of deterrence. And was that just because of the listener questions, or because how your gut reaction to this?
Well, that's what we talked about on the Mincing Rascals. Austin Berg, who's a frequent guest from the Illinois Policy Institute, myself, John Williams, were kind of just wondering aloud of, you know, the thought of trying to solve this in court. Yes, you want convictions and you want sentences for people who do bad things, but the root of the political corruption in Chicago, a lot of it stems from the fact that older people are allowed to have second jobs and are awarded contracts with constituents or businesses that want the services of the older person. I mean, like, that is what I would solve. If I'm talking about deterrence, I would pay older people more, and I would say, but you cannot earn any other money while you're in the gig. I don't think waiting for the federal gears to pile through are the deterrent factor.
Yeah, to me, a lot of the issues with deterrence. So deterrence comes up in literally every sentencing hearing. Doesn't matter the case. It could be a federal gun case, a federal corruption case. It doesn't matter. It's one of the things the parties are always arguing about, because, you know, there's data on all these issues. There are scholars who write articles about deterrence. And, you know, the defense side, which I'm on, we often cite these studies that say, look, the deterrent effect of a sentence on others at large in the society is minimal to non-existent, meaning that if you give a particular person a particular term of incarceration, there's very little evidence that deters others from engaging in the same conduct. And so we believe that it's not really true that giving a large sentence to someone in a situation is all of a sudden going to change the conduct of others.
Mike, can I have a follow-up to that. Yeah. I have a follow-up to that. These studies that you cite, are you talking about like individual sentences don't deter others? Or could you make the argument that if society or a city or an area decides to really go after and institute longer sentences, that the cumulative effect can deter things ultimately?
Well, that's what people say. I mean, a lot of judges believe that to be true, meaning that if a judge gives out a long sentence to a defendant, which there was a case a couple years ago by a really good judge who's no longer in the federal bench, Judge Feinerman, gave a politician, and you could argue, you know, similar circumstances, an 11-year sentence, and he went out of his way to basically say, look, this is a message to the political community, and we are sending a message that longer sentences will accompany conduct that's engaged in, that's of a criminal nature by a politician. And he was basically saying it's going to deter others, and whether it actually deters others or not, maybe doesn't matter, but that something has to change, and we're going to try to change it the way that, you know, under what's under our control as judges, okay? So then if you look at a lot of the sentences that have been given over the last, you know, couple decades in Chicago, George Ryan got 6 years, Blagojevich got 14, Dennis Hastert got 15 months, Joseph Moreno got 14 years, Luis Arroyo got 5. In my view, it's difficult to say that any of those sentences had any effect on any other politician. I don't think it's true. I don't think the evidence supports it. But I understand from the societal standpoint and sending a message standpoint that, and from a judge's standpoint, they might think that, hey, we got to keep sending a message to these people that they can't do this.
What if they all got 25 though, Mike? Right? Like, what if all of them got 25?
Well, then, yeah, then maybe something would change. Maybe not. You know, a lot of the data and the scholars say that it's the certainty that you will get incarceration, not the length of time that you're going to serve. Hmm. So it's a tough call, though. But if you're the judge in this case, you know, what does it say to Chicago and Illinois if you don't give him a term of incarceration or a substantial term of incarceration? That's a lot of pressure on the court, too, because people are going to react. And no matter what Judge Kendall does, people are going to say it's too little or it's too much. So it's a difficult one. Then there's no wrong or right answer. And no. I think if you've read stories about Burke's upcoming sentencing hearing, that's what a lot of the articles are about. Does deterrence work? Does it not work? You know, what can we do here? But I think your solution is more to the point. If you barred politicians from having other lines of work, which overlap with their business as politicians, to me, that would be more effective than a one-off sentencing determinations in terms of changing things.
Thank you. I appreciate you agreeing with me there. I think that's a no-brainer solution. I do think my one part of the argument that people hate is when I say that older people deserve more money. They don't deserve more money. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Some do, some don't. But that you have to pay them more to disincentivize the idea of them trying to do something corrupt behind the scenes. And I think that saves the city a lot more money in the long run. Double their salaries. There's only 50 of them. That amount of money pales in comparison to the corruption that comes from them having other gigs. So whether you think they deserve it or not, if it helps the taxpayer out and helps, you know, generally corruption, I think that's a good way to do it. But a lot of texts are coming in, Mike. 847 says he's too old because it took too long to bring him justice. Yeah, the wheels of justice move slowly in the federal bench. And, right, like, if he was 70, I don't know if everyone would have the same argument. Things take so long to bring to court and to get convictions on that maybe he shouldn't be rewarded because he grinded the gears slowly.
Well, I understand the argument, and that's an argument that argument just made by the listener is one of the exact arguments the government made in their sentencing memo. Like, hey, it doesn't matter that he's of this age. You know, that's when we got him, and he was in his 70s when he committed the conduct. I didn't think the government made the argument very strongly, but I think it's a good point by the listener for sure. And, you know, there's this sort of underlying theory in the government's position that, gee, we got him for these ones. He must have been doing other things bad before with no evidence of that. So I think we got to be a little careful, you know, painting this broad brush that, gee, because we got him now, that means he's been doing this for decades. There's no evidence of that. Nothing was presented in court. There was nothing admitted that supports that. So it's a tough one, though. I understand people on both sides of this issue for sure.
Right, because a jury isn't allowed to consider, well, maybe he there's not enough to sway me here, but he probably has done this in the before, so I'll find him guilty. We don't want our juries doing that. So if that's the case, we should not want our judges to extrapolate down a similar line for sentencing either.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is the one time, I think, if you're a listener or a non-lawyer and you wanted to read something, these sentencing memos are actually very readable. You know, they're very practical. The defense lawyers tell kind of the story of his whole life and really paint him in a certain way. And then the government, in very simple language and simple arguments, points him in the exact opposite way. And what they do is they really emphasize the facts of the case. They try to argue that he's not shown remorse. They try to make this big argument about deterrence. So I think they're very readable, interesting documents, and all of your listeners, all those questions they're asking are things that both sides are arguing in their sentencing memos, which is kind of fun.
All right, Mike, quickly, before the break, what's your over-under? I'm going 4.5. I know this is like a macabre thing to do with the person's life, but I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, I think it'll be difficult for the court not to give him a term of incarceration, so I would say in the range of 36 months, something like that.
You really think it could be 3 years?
Yeah, that would be. I mean, I'm just guessing. I mean, I'm not saying that's an appropriate sentence. I'm just making a guess. But something like that, I could also see, which would cause a lot of public backlash of the court saying that he can serve the term not in a prison, that he could serve it, home confinement or something like that, based upon his age and a number of documented medical issues. So if the judge did that, that wouldn't surprise me either.
Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney from Leonard Trial Lawyers, also represents whistleblowers in cases. And you've actually filed a lawsuit, Mike Leonard, that sounds like something Patrick Dolan, our good friend, would file on behalf of a well-known soccer coach, right?
Yeah, let's hope Patrick's not listening, okay? And then can you bar him from listening to this episode when you post it? But
yeah,
we have an interesting case where we actually filed it about 2 years ago, but we just got word this week that it's going to get to go to trial, which is always fun and kind of the pinnacle for us. But the basic facts are we represent an individual who was hired as the head coach of the Red Stars, the women's professional soccer team in Chicago, in January of 2022. The league, the National Women's Soccer League, intervened and said, no, you can't hire this individual. He had an arrest from about 10 years ago. We're not going to let you hire him. Okay. The problem with that, in Illinois, like a lot of states, you can't refuse to hire someone because of a prior arrest. And in our case, the arrest was really a minimal thing where the charges weren't even pursued. It was a situation where our client was involved in basically a shoving match with someone when he was picking up his children. And so he was denied the position with the Red Stars. We filed a lawsuit against the Red Stars in the league. We settled the claim against the Red Stars. And just this week, we had to have argument before the court because the league was trying to get out of the case before trial on what's called something that's called summary judgment, arguing that, hey, judge, based upon the deposition testimony and the law, here's why we win. Here's why there shouldn't be a trial. The judge denied that motion, so we'll get to go to trial sometime later this year on behalf of this head coach candidate who was denied position, and the defendant will be the National Women's Soccer League.
You can't be fired preemptively or not given a job because of an earlier arrest?
Correct. That's the law in the state of Illinois. Which
I'm sure Patrick's told me that before. It just went over my head.
Yeah. Yeah, and this case is a perfect example because you had a situation where our client comes to pick up his kids at the home of his ex-wife. Her boyfriend's there, is hassling him. A shoving match, ensues, and the wife gets in the middle and happens to be knocked to the floor because of the two gentlemen pushing each other. And, of course, the police don't pursue it. The ex-wife didn't think anything wrong had happened. She fully supported him. So it's not a reason, in our view, to deny someone a position. And under Illinois law, that is illegal to deny someone a position because of an arrest. And so it'll be a fun trial, and we really look forward to getting this one before a jury.
I mean, that definitely sounded like what he says happened there, Mike. Is that what the arrest documents?
Oh yeah,
say
that's
as well.
What the documents say. Yeah,
I just don't want to leave the listener not saying that I didn't challenge you a little bit on the facts of the case here.
No, John, I love to be challenged on the facts case. No, there's really no dispute about what happened. And there are police reports that document what happened. And the ex-wife will probably testify to trial and say that's exactly what happened. That's really never been a point of contention in the case. But the league does have, in their view, you know, control over these teams and can dictate whether someone can be hired or not. And they try to put language in the coaches' contracts to say that they can override the teams. So, yeah, that's not really a big point of contention in the case, what you just raised. But I'm happy to be challenged, John. I love being cross-examined.
I mean, this really is an employment law question.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, yeah, some of the trials we take to verdict are whistleblowers, or really this would be a classic employment case. It's not really a whistleblower case. So, you know, we do try a number of types of civil cases, aren't just, you know, anything to do with criminal cases, even though there's an arrest involved. This is not a criminal case.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll follow that one as you go through there and go to trial. Let's talk a little bit about the U.S. Supreme Court, which has dropped a number of cases, as is the case in June usually. And as always, the most controversial ones are punted till the final week of releases, which we're expecting to be next week. We've still got a lot of outstanding cases. The former President Trump's immunity claims are there. A case called, I think they're colloquially calling it Fishers, the idea whether these January 6th defendants should be charged with stopping an official proceeding or not. That is definitely one of the big charges against them. A lot of them, I should say, that many have been found guilty of, if I'm not mistaken, and whether that should be the case. There's been some gun rights cases. I don't know, Mike, where do you want to go with this in reading the tea leaves or reading the decisions over the past couple weeks?
Yeah, I think you make a great point that some of the ones that have yet to come out will be most exciting for us and the listeners to talk about in the coming week. So everyone clearly is awaiting how they address the immunity issue. I think it's going to be somewhere in the middle where the Supreme Court says that there could be immunity based upon certain acts if you're not acting in your official capacity, and they'll remand it back to the trial court to have a hearing, evidentiary hearing, to decide, to try to further decide, you know, what immunity has, if any. So I think that case and that issue is going to still be alive for a while, but we're all kind of waiting with bated breath for the Supreme Court to rule.
Do you think they'll define like what those circumstances are, or do you think they're really just going to toe a middle line here where they say he doesn't have, maybe not have immunity in this case, but we'll let the lower courts adjudicate that first, and we're not making a blanket statement about presidential immunity moving forward?
Well, they have to do a couple things. Number one, they have to come up with rules or principles that define when a president has immunity and when he doesn't, right? They're definitely going to give us the rules of the game. The question is, are they going to apply the rules of the game to the facts before them, or are they going to push it back to the trial court and say, okay, now that you know what the parameters are that we've just given you and what the law really is and where he has immunity and where he doesn't, go have an evidentiary hearing and make the determination as to what in the indictment stays and what goes. And that's what I think is going to happen. But no, they're not just going to punt it back and say, hey, figure this out. They're going to give them clear rules of the game, so to speak, a clear statement of law. And then the trial court's going to have to figure out, okay, based upon the Supreme Court ruling, you know, which of these counts in the indictment will stay and which ones will go. And I think that it will take either further briefing by the parties, but more likely maybe even sort of an evidentiary hearing where there's testimony.
Yeah, I just think we need to know the guardrails, whether you end up disagreeing with them or agreeing with them. I mean, this goes beyond the former president. I mean, this goes on to the future of what that office means in our country, right?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a big issue. It's not just for the Trump case. I mean, obviously going forward, we're going to face the same issue in different presidencies. It certainly may come up if Trump wins, because there may be certain prosecutions of political figures based upon their conduct in office. So clearly we all need, society needs, politicians need, everyone needs, not just for the Trump case, a clear statement of law by the Supreme Court as to what acts are immune and what aren't. So that's going to be a hugely important issue and case to be delivered by the Supreme Court in the next couple of weeks.
We've had two firearms cases, too, and both kind of one on each side of the spectrum. That happens a lot with Supreme Court cases, is that you get one that conservatives love and you get one that liberals love the results of. I'm not saying that's done by design, but that often happens in the case. We saw the 8-1 decision yesterday about that, you know, someone that's a domestic abuser currently in litigation about that cannot apply for a firearm, but you saw some on the other side. I mean, this is just kind of how these always play out here in June.
Yeah, well, one of the big issues that still exists for federal defense attorneys like me is there's a law on the federal books called what's referred to as the felon in possession law, right, which bars someone who has a prior felony from possessing, owning a firearm. So you can be charged merely because you're possessing a gun, because you had in your past a criminal conviction. So we're all hoping and waiting for the Supreme Court to rule, and they did this week, but they really didn't answer the question, but they partially did. I mean, so in one case, they've held that, hey, look, if you're a domestic abuser, you can, in fact, be denied a firearm, but they didn't specifically answer the question of what it means to be a felon in possession of a firearm. They certainly left open an argument for all defense attorneys like me, because the Supreme Court basically said if someone poses a clear threat or danger to another, they can be denied a firearm. So what's going to happen, John, in a lot of cases is people like me are going to be arguing, hey, look, the felony that this person has in their past, it's nonviolent. You know, it might be a white collar case. It could be anything that's not violent. And therefore, there's no reason to deny them a firearm to be a firearm holder in the future based on something that's not a threat to people or society. So,
yeah, I think
a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah, getting in the weeds here a little bit. I think they're looking for a more sympathetic felon. I hate to say it like that, but to make a case that is broadly more speaking about other felons and other felon cases, because this character certainly was not. And I think it was a no-brainer, the decision that they ultimately ended up making in this particular case. Hey, Mike, we're out of time. I love chatting with you. Thanks for chopping it up for a whole hour. We'll do it again soon, okay?
Enjoyed it, John. Thanks for costing you all of your Notre Dame viewership. But hey, you know.
No, the guy actually said who called you a clown, he apologized. He said you ended up giving a very good answer. Mike Leonard, we'll talk again soon. I appreciate it, okay?
Right. Thanks, John. Take care.